Bring to order the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency. It's Thursday, March 28th. And we're going to take up a bill that we carried over from last Thursday. And with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3172. Bob, remind us of what House Bill 3172 is, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3172 requires evaluation of the septic system of residential real property and report of that evaluation to a buyer, allows the buyer to withdraw the offer for property within 7 days of receiving the report, and allows the buyer to revoke the offer if the seller fails or refuses to provide the evaluation report.
Thank you. And we have up two people who really didn't get an ample opportunity last week. And so could I have Peggy Lynch and Richard Blitz? Welcome back, Richard, and thank you again for making the trip. Apologize for not being able to get ample time for you last week.
So I appreciate the invitation
Tuesday,
back.
I guess.
Thank you.
Seems like last week, but actually it was Tuesday.
2 days ago, yeah.
My name is Richard Litz. I'm the monitoring coordinator for 10 Mile Lakes Basin Partnership in Lakeside, Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to reiterate our points that our group was trying to make at the last hearing. We support the unamended bill because it requires a professional assessment of the septic system, and the consequences of allowing improperly functioning systems continue to be ignored is too great. It's just too big of a problem. And this is an opportunity when we have the sale going on to stop the septic system problems from going forward from that point on. I gave you a brief summary of the science last time, but the gist of that is that the effluents from the unmaintained septic systems gets into our waterways, and in particular for 10 Mile Lakes, it creates harmful algae blooms. And if you remember the attachment 3, I actually sent you this picture of what an algae bloom looks like, because I figured probably most of you had never actually seen an algae bloom. And I just ask you for a minute to imagine this is your backyard, and you've spent, you know, however many thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars for a lakefront home, and you invite your guests over, and this is what your backyard looks like. It's it's got been certainly an unaesthetic pleasing or unpleasing look to it, but a bigger concern is actually the fact that the algae that are contained in this, these blooms, are potentially toxic. There are neurotoxins and hepatotoxins, and we have found toxins every year that we have tested for them, which is basically all the last 10 years. Children and pets are especially prone to these toxins because of their small weight. And I really hope that we don't wait to get to a point where we've got, you know, an Oregonian headline of some child dying because of a toxic algae bloom that is related to our septic issues. In addition, we have economic effects, which were spoken to briefly by some of the people that were here last week, including let me back up a second and say, when these blue-green algae blooms happen, the state, if it gets over a certain level, the state issues a recreational advisory to warn people about it, and which is the proper thing to do. But then that, of course, affects the businesses, hotel cancellations, marinas start losing business, and then, of course, the subsequent things of just people not being there with a loss of restaurant businesses. And then long-term-wise, the people find another lake to go to. And, you know, the empty shops on our main street are a good example of what can happen. And, of course, that's not all due to the algae problem, but it certainly isn't helping any. And finally, the home values go down. And I think this is probably one of the most frustrating parts of this for folks like me and the people who are here on Tuesday. All of us have done the right thing. We all have our septic systems taken care of. We maintain them. We have paid the money to make sure that that has happened over the years. And yet, because of our neighbors' unlawful neglect of these, and it is unlawful, it is not lawful to have a septic system that is putting sewage into the water. And yet, because of their neglect, we all end up suffering the consequences, and we end up paying double because we not only have the money that we've paid out to maintain our systems, but also the fact that our property values are going down. And some of the homes on our lake have been for sale for years now because it's very difficult when you look at some of these kind of things to do that. So the fundamental question for this bill comes down to whether or not we're going to continue to ignore the unlawful sellers who own defective septic systems and hope they can sneak in by an uninformed buyer, or are we willing to stand up and demand that they fix the problem before passing it off to another person? Many sellers simply do not have the knowledge to adequately assess their own systems and give reliable information to a potential buyer. Would any of you honestly be able to evaluate your own septic system? And many buyers are equally uninformed about the questions to ask and the importance of having a reliable, properly functioning septic system, especially if the buyer is coming from an urban environment. In the heat and stress of a home sale, it is not the time to let buyers or sellers decide if they want to skip an inspection, which is frequently done, just to keep the sale moving forward more rapidly. I urge you to support the original bill that requires a professional, independent septic report so that all parties involved will have a realistic and reliable assessment of the system before the sale. It is our chance to bring these unmaintained systems up to a lawful standard at a time when money might actually be most available to do it during the sale. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Litz. Did you have a question, Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Litz, I've got two questions. One is, are toxic algae blooms only caused by septic effluents?
No. The septic algae toxic algae blooms are caused when the waters have more nutrients in them, which is in most cases phosphorus is the thing we're looking at. And there's a lot of different sources for phosphorus. But what are that graph that I had showed of attachment one shows you that the phosphorus levels are actually coming down during the springtime, and in June they're bottoming out, and then they start to go back up again. Well, we don't have anything coming into our system at that point.
The second thing is that we're talking about a lake, and I've had a home with toxic algae problems, and we dealt with it and so forth, but it wasn't caused by sewer or sewage. But we did have a problem where if there wasn't clay, the lake drained. And if there is clay, then that which is on the other side of the clay can't get through the barrier any more than the water can come out. Yeah. And so it seems strange that septic effluents,
yeah,
can make it through the bottom of the lake to come into the lake, but that the water in the lake doesn't drain out.
It's not going through the bottom of the lake. It's going right in.
Yeah, I think if I understand what you mean.
There's no drain field.
Your houses are up here, so when it drains down, it's simply draining down through the mountainside or the hillside, the slope that's going from your house or your drain field, depending upon where it's leaking, into the lake in that way.
So it's just pouring into.
It goes through the ground water, but it's not necessarily going, you know, it's not necessarily on the surface.
Okay.
Some are bad enough that it might be, but yeah, it can go through the rock and pour us through, just like all water would that rains.
Water finds its way.
Gravity.
Yes.
So,
the point is that if you have water in a lake that doesn't flow out those cracks, then it may be a jump to say that all of the problem is caused by effluents that's coming through the cracks. Anyway, just a thought.
Certainly. Well, I appreciate your testimony and coming back, and I want to get Peggy Lynch on the record now, please. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you, Mr. Chair, for holding this committee, this hearing again today. Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. I've submitted two letters that are on your OLIS document. One was submitted, dated the 21st, and submitted last Tuesday. One was just submitted, I believe, last night, so it should be on today's OLIS. And I also, your committee administrator or assistant was very nice to put our coastal study on OLIS on Tuesday's website. You can look in the side and on page 32 of this document, probably 34 of your OLIS document. There's a whole discussion about non-point source pollution and water quality and issues surrounding this. We support the original bill as well. And before I forget the comment, then the question that Representative Richardson asked, Mr. Chair, if you've been to 10 Mile Lakes, and my grandparents used to fish there years and years ago, I was on that lake, there are still systems for which the pipe goes directly into the lake. So it doesn't go through a drain field. And then there are, that you know, it's because nobody has caught it. It's not, I mean, Mr. Lips is right. It's illegal, but it's true. Frankly, in the interim, when we had a discussion of this bill during the interim, Representative Deborah Boone shared exactly that story. When she purchased her home located in the coastal zone, she discovered that the septic tank went directly into the nearby river. Obviously, she's fixed it immediately, but that's exactly what's happening in our rural areas of Oregon. I lived on, when I first grew up in on Lake Creek in Lane County, we had a one-holer. Now, I'm guessing that they probably have a septic system now, but I won't guarantee you that it's a very good septic system or one that's working. I wanted to provide you with some statistics, since that was what you were asking the last time. According to DEQ...
And Ms. Lynch, did you supply those to us in writing?
I did, but I'm going to just... So I'm going to shorten it.
If you could wrap it up, I got a legislator waiting.
I'm sorry, Representative Clem, I'll hurry. So 70% of Oregonians, including 90% of rural residents, rely on groundwater. And 30% of all single-family homes are on septic, on-site septic systems. And so on the 21st letter, there is statistics about Dune City and the of the 69% of their septic systems that were tested, 12% failed. And the 28th letter, I talk about the McKinsey and upstream of eWeb's intake. Over 4,000 septic systems exist. And during a temporary program of 439 systems that were inspected, 108 needed pump outs, and 55 systems needed significant repairs or replacement. And in Lapine, to make sure that we're not just talking, I want to make sure we get the whole state here. Lapine has over 4,000 lots for which there is an issue because of the porous ground and the high water table. And they are, DEQ is working to try to resolve that issue, but it is a challenging issue. So I hope you read our letters. I think they are factual and informative. This is not the first time that you have seen this issue in this bill. We are talking about Oregon's, the public health of Oregonians. We understand there is an issue about the cost of this. We know that there is a fund in DEQ that was supposed to be used to help the Multnomah County people get onto a sewer system instead of septics. We think that there can be money that can be found to help low-income Oregonians deal with this issue, but we have got to take care of our clean water and our the public health of Oregonians.
Thank you
for your time.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3172 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3326.
Thank you.
Representative Clem. Well, we don't want that to happen. Mr. Long, please.
Please.
Only because you're in my committee later today, Mr. Chair.
What goes around comes around. So, welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record, we are in public hearing on House Bill 3326.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brian Clem, state representative from right here in Salem, District 21, and happy to talk to you about House Bill 3326. There's some dash one amendments. There'll, as you'll hear, need to be some more amendments because I just saw the list of all the people here opposed to the bill. So don't get excited about things. We'll have lots of conversations. I think there's a call next week with some of the excellent people from the fire service to talk about their concerns, and we're interested in working with everybody. But let me tell you what the genesis of the bill was in the first place that generated all these. I try to bring bills, non-controversial bills, but I didn't do it in this case. Sorry. Okay. So what sparked my interest in this, and actually it was, I've talked to some of you about this before in this committee, some of the touring I've done around the state on economic development projects, occasionally what we find is there might be some agencies and or some rules that just don't apply that well in this situation in deep eastern Oregon or in deep southern Oregon. So this is a case where you've got the head of an agency who knows what some of those rules are, and some of the folks that I know, and Representative Smith's part of the world and Representative Bent's part of the world, my other chief sponsor here, they talk to me about some of their projects and what makes a project viable or not, and what some of the codes are that apply to the whole state versus, you know, what's kind of going on out in these rural parts of the state where they're the only landowner for 30 square miles and nobody around them. There's nobody around them at all, and so, you know, do you build to an urban big city building code standard in a place where you're the only person, and if your house has a problem, it's you and your other house that's right next to you for your ranch hand, you know, over fire issues or whatever the issues are. So what we were trying to do here is find some policy where, because it's hard to write for the exception, where the director of DCBS could, on a literally one-off basis, say yes to some different types of codes when it just doesn't make any sense. And if it doesn't make sense for any kind of public safety or other reason, and it makes the project financially impossible to build to the urban code, and it doesn't make any sense, this gives the director the ability to limit the application of the normal code in that situation, just on a one-by-one sort of appeal basis almost. Then there's some other parts of the bill. That's the some of the other parts we have to talk about that have to do with people who are trying to get some help from their building official when they're trying to get their plans approved. And the question is, at what point do they really need to not get help from the building official and go back and pay to their engineer or architect to get the help? And so we're trying to find that line where the person cannot just be a no. If you go in, you're trying to do a plan, and all you get is no's, it gets discouraging. If it's a no, but here, if you do this differently, as long as we don't get into the practice of actually giving them real structural and other kinds of advice that they are not qualified to do, can we find a line where they can be more helpful on how to get to yes on projects and not just, sorry, I can't talk to you about that, go back and hire somebody? Because that's not fun for the applicant. It's sometimes necessary, but it certainly slows down the desire to do projects when you feel like the regulator is obstinate. In this case, I think we have a regulator who kind of knows what I'm talking about in his department and is willing to work on it. We've obviously got some folks who want to make sure we don't drag them into a whole new system that screws up public safety, screws up fire safety. So, you know, we have some conversations to have in a very short time, obviously. But that's essentially the genesis of the bill. You know, I've been involved in a few where I knew every detail of their project, so I knew, and they said, look, we got through because we had enough resources to get through these. No one else is ever going to want to do this again if they have to go through that. So could we try and fix some of this, you know, so nobody else has to do this again and find a way to make it fit? And that's the genesis of the bill.
Thank you, Representative Clement. I know you were trying to get out of here by 1:20. I apologize because it's 1:22.
No problem. Thank you very much.
And maybe I'll have Brian Krieg come on up and replace Representative Clem since he's signed up in favor of this bill.
And then all the rest are opposed.
I know. I'll get the proponents up first because I don't see a lot of proponents.
I have
Go ahead.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, I'm filling some rather big shoes here, is now replacing Representative Clem. I think that's a whole new level for me as a lobbyist. I am here today representing the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors Association, and I think at the core of the issue here is the situation that we do develop codes, and SMACNA is very involved with it nationally, and they're very important. Fire life safety are very critical items, and make no doubt about that. But codes are developed dominantly by folks who are in suburban urban environments. We have studies now, you know, that the United States is living not in the rural part of the country anymore from the population standpoint, but in suburban and urban. That reflects. And in our urban environment, or suburban, let's say, rural environments, we do need to take a look at maybe easing a few things, making it a little bit more flexible because the situations are a little bit different out there. We don't want to let everything just go by any means. And it is very important that we do keep unified codes across the state. But providing a little bit of flexibility and the concept of can we get to yes on certain projects is out there. SMACNA, therefore, supports the concepts in the bill and is looking forward to the discourse that will happen over the next few weeks to try and get to yes. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Long, I know you didn't sign up, but I think Representative Clem signed you up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Mark Long, Administrator of State Building Codes. You may recall when we were here on other bills, I shared with the committee kind of the health of what's going on in the counties out there from a building permit standpoint, and I'm just kind of holding up a chart here. The green areas are the ones that have had significant permit count reductions over the last 5 years, and then this is the revenue picture. The orange areas are a 40 to 80% decline in many of our counties and cities out there in eastern Oregon. So I was asked at the beginning of the session or before, what could we do to help improve the regulation in rural Oregon, but for Oregon as a whole? And so I'm going to talk about this bill specifically, but I also want to create a kind of a theme here. This bill is part of a package that unfortunately didn't get all into the same committee, but where we hope to train the inspectors working in the local areas and give them more flexibility, multi-headed, combination training, custom approaches. That bill was Chair Daugherty's committee, it's been successful over there. The other piece was the smart codes concept and the customer choices and the decision-making that are contained in House Bill 3326. And then the last component was the ability to do partnership agreements between the state and counties, which we'll talk about in another bill potentially, so that we can really try to help these rural areas remain viable. And that's kind of the genesis behind this piece, as well as the things that Representative Clem talked about. I'd just like to go through 3326 very quickly. I'll do section by section because each section is different and they don't necessarily connect with each other, and they're attempted to accomplish a particular policy objective. In the first page, the first three sections are really about the legislature sending policy direction to my organization to have special consideration when we're adopting codes that may impact structures that are in remote areas. And we've been very careful not to. A lot of folks have asked me, what's the definition of that, Mark? Where does it apply? Is it this county? Is it that county? What's the population level? And I've been very careful to not do that because I've been doing this for quite a while, and I really don't like situations where one party on one side of the street gets the flexibility and then the party on another side of the street because of a demarcation point doesn't. So it's really policy direction to my organization. I have seven boards that I work with a lot of the folks that are in this room on an ongoing basis to adopt the codes, and I have confidence in our experts, both at the local government level and our stakeholders, Brian's clients and others, to help us figure out what is necessary and where we can provide that relief on the code side. So that's really the first page. When you move into parts of Section 3 and parts of Section 4, I was attempted to get at some of the things that we heard about as far as decision-making that occurs in some of the remote areas. Sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes when you get in these very remote areas, issues around fire access and supply can become problematic when you're a long ways away from a response anyway, and it can be quite costly and particularly hard to manage in parts of eastern Oregon. So there was an attempt to try to look at that set of issues and see if there's some clarity we can provide I've been had a lot of conversations, you can imagine, since the bill got printed, and just on this area, I think there's a lot of work to do, and we've committed to working with the fire service to see what kind of options, and we're really talking about two different sets of situations that I want to clarify to the committee. There's one side where there's a building code standard itself that's been adopted by my organization. And because of things that have occurred at the national level, sometimes those new construction provisions get caught up in some of the maintenance provisions of the fire codes the local officials adopt, and you have situations where a contractor and a building inspector will go into a building, authorize the building, and somebody asks for it to be done differently. We need to get those new construction things kind of tightened up. There's a series of AG's opinions that go clear back to the early 1980s, and we're attempting to try to get that law fixed. This bill didn't do that as written, but that's what the purpose is. On the water supply and access issues, those are the more substantive issues for the fire community, and that's where we have a lot of work, and we've just talked conceptually about getting together after this committee and seeing what we can come up with, so I'll probably be bringing different ideas to you there, and I don't have a silver bullet there yet. When you get into Section 4, this was the idea, and Representative Clem talked about it, where it's my hope that we can provide for our owner-builders out there some typical drawings that would help them when you build a pole barn or some of these very basic structures that are accessory to houses and wood frame types of units. We've been thinking about Group U. It's a technical term at the Building Codes Division, but it's really, it would deal with single-family residences and then accessories to single-family residences and pole barns that would be regulated. There are pole barns that are exempt, and there are pole barns that are regulated, and we think that we can provide clarity to people who are trying to build and have those drawings up front, so when a customer came in, they just know if they did it a particular way, and if that worked for them, they could get through the plan review and the regulatory system. The second piece of Section 4 was to empower our building inspectors to provide additional assistance to customers when they had maybe a problem with their plan, wherever it came from, if there was an architect or engineer involved or not, because what happens is people bring their drawings in, our inspectors are certified, they're trained, they know the code provisions, the life safety provisions, and they know exactly what needs to be changed, but they're hesitant to do that. It's not clear that they can. Some do, some don't. We want to clarify that they should and they could, because when you can provide that level of change right there with the customer, kind of over the counter, that plan can get approved right away. If you don't, it gets back to the bottom of the pile, you start all over again, there's a huge delay, and when you're dealing in remote areas as well as urban areas, those delays are very costly, and especially when you have to drive back and forth because the office where you get your permits isn't necessarily convenient. So that's Section 4. And then Section 5 was merely designed as a relief valve. The thinking being, if we're going to train our officials better, we're going to provide greater flexibility in the codes that we currently have as well as these new codes, we're going to clarify some decision making, we're going to make it easier to help the customer with some plans and some drawings and hopefully make that work more efficiently, that for some reason, if those flexibility tools weren't being used, that there could be a relief valve for the customer to come ask my organization for help. You're going to hear that there's significant concerns with probably the last three areas I talked about around the fire piece, the Section 4 around the architect's piece and engineer's piece, and around Section 5. The policy issue for us, and I've been doing this for quite some time, is when you do have a situation where a customer's stuck for whatever particular reason is, what's the relief valve you're going to provide for that customer? And sometimes it doesn't exist. And so that's kind of the genesis of this bill. It's part of a package, better training, codes, some customer choices, a relief valve, and then we also believe that 3144 connects in some way because we think that the way is to partner with these communities that are struggling. So with that, I'll be happy to take any questions that you have.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And we have a pretty long agenda today. It sounds like you're going to be coming back with amendments on this bill that we're going to have to talk about all over again. So we'll sort of cut short on the questions because we'll probably have more questions when this bill comes back with amendments.
And be happy to pop back up if you need a clarification.
Okay. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Long. Part of the concept I heartily endorse as a builder. I totally endorse what Rep. Clem's trying to accomplish here, and to some degree, it does vary significantly by county, in terms of the attitude and the ability to help in that process. I mean, there are counties you walk in, and the first word you get from the county planner is no. Before they know what you're trying to do. But there are counties, and Hood River County being one of them, where our building official, in fact, does prescriptive path framing diagrams showing you exactly if you want to accomplish this. This is what kind of stuff we will accept, giving, you know, not just the folks in the business, but the weekend warriors, if you will, some tracks to run on. Also, they also will help prescribing, you know, beams, doing beam calcs and so forth as well, where there's an issue sometimes. So that can be, that's great, and I think that's what you're trying to encourage the folks on the local level to participate in. They have the skills, they have the access to information, and if they can make that available to people at the local level, it can really help the process. So I applaud that. Getting back to the concept, though, of urban versus rural codes, could you give some specifics of what you're talking about there? Because I'm not quite clear. You're just simply maybe trying to streamline the inspection process from the standpoint of enabling an inspector.
And Representative Johnson, if we could get you to follow up with that question and come back to the committee with it when this bill comes back, I'd really appreciate it. Because they're going to have an amendment to this bill, we're going to have to go back through this and get that specifically. I'd like to get the rest of the people on the record.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to circle back with it.
Yeah, circle back with that question, and, you know, we the whole committee would like to hear the answer to that. Thank
sure.
you.
Thank you.
Up next, I have Cindy Robert and Sue Lasso.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I'm with the American Institute of Architects, Oregon, and I'll be very brief because I can tell the chair would like to move quickly on, and I will just say two things. First of all, as this bill is currently written, it has a wonderful section, too, that talks about the importance of rural structures and some of the flexibility. Architects agree with that 100%. The rest of the bill has nothing to do with the rural structures or any size building limitation. It's any size building anywhere in Oregon. The problem for the architects is simply this. There are currently buildings that are exempt from architecture and engineering law. Architect and engineering law talks about what you all believe when you put the statute together was in the best interest of the public safety. Those buildings must have an architect or engineer involved. Other buildings do not. Those are the buildings in the rural areas that I was at first thought this bill had to do with, but is much broader now. So those buildings that are currently exempt from architect licensure and having to use an architect are residences, farm buildings, auxiliary buildings, including garages, barns, shed, livestock facilities, a building under 4,000 square feet that's less than 20 feet high. So those are the pole barns for the most part that we're talking about, and those are the ones that don't need an architect or engineer involved. The rest of them, you've said, it's important for public safety that an architect or engineer be involved. And when an architect or engineer is involved and it goes to a building official to have a permit, if that building official changes anything on that building plan, the liability is gone. Poof. So the relief valve just put a whole different, you know, releasing it, just put a whole different pressure on the public because now you guys are responsible if the building falls down. The architect no longer had control of those plans. Those kinds of buildings need to be sent back to the architect or engineer to fix. If, in fact, there is a problem with the timing, that person then goes to the back of the line, I think that's what you've been told. Well, we got to be able to fix these simple things where the person goes to the back of the line. Well, the simple versus the non-simple is already drawn out in statute by what's exempt and what's not. And those things that are not have to go back to the architect or engineer for liability purposes, and then we can decide from there what happens next. But if it's timing issue, that's the building codes division's issue. You've already stated your opinion on what buildings are important for the health and welfare of the public.
Thank you. Could you introduce yourself for the record,
yes,
please?
Chair Holvey and members of the committee, thank you for letting me testify today. My name is Sue Laszlo, and I'm the chair of the American Council of Engineering Companies, as ACEC, Oregon Legislative Committee. And ACEC is a professional organization representing more than 110 member firms and 35 100 employees in Oregon, and our members range from small locally owned firms to major companies providing design services to public and private clients across the nation. I'm also a registered professional engineer and vice president of HDR Engineering and the past president and emeritus member of the Oregon State Board of Engineering Examiners and Land Surveyors, and continue to be active in my profession and community. And I'm here to testify today in opposition of House Bill 3326. And in summary, we see the problems with this bill are as follows. The House bill gives the director of the Oregon Department of Consumer and Business Services complete power to adopt alternative building code requirements if the code is deemed unclear, duplicative, inadequate, or unsuitable. And there are no qualifications as to location, type of structure, or anything else that would keep this entity from amending the code as they see fit. We also see that the building official, department employee, or building inspector is able to act as a design consultant, but then stipulates that if they do so, they're not engaged in the practice of engineering. And finally, we see that the public sector employees are able to charge for these services as if they were private consultants, and this would be in direct competition with the private sector companies without having to carry insurance, business, or professional engineering licensure. So in summary, we see that this bill does not protect the public, and it allows the building official to take design responsibility and offer it to the public without the benefit of a professional licensure, much as what Cindy had just mentioned. And so I thank you for your consideration, and I'm also providing testimony today in opposition from one of our rural member design firms out in Lakeview. So thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony, and it looks like we do have some conversations that need to go on about this bill. So I encourage you to talk to Mr. Long and see if you know there's some background that we can take care of offline.
Very good.
Up next, we have Tracy Rutten, Melanie Adams, and Dan Eisenbeiss. Speaking from the city's point of view, and I appreciate it if you could summarize the city's position, I suppose, in general.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tracy Rutten, and I'm here today with the League of Oregon Cities. I'm testifying today in opposition to House Bill 3326. And as you've heard from other parties who've testified, we're interested in flexible tools to address the needs of rural Oregon. However, the bill as drafted causes substantial concerns in our ability to maintain local control over building inspection programs. These concerns include broad language, which calls into question what is considered to be rural or remote, broad language around discretionary powers granted to the director, these powers allowing the director to limit the application of a specialty code provision if it's unclear, duplicative, inadequate, or unsuitable. It's difficult for us to understand what this means and in what circumstances the code may be considered to be unclear or inadequate. But Section 5 is where we have our largest concerns. We have been informed that this section is standalone and does not pertain specifically to the use of these rural smart codes. We do not think that the section is necessary in order to implement flexible tools to address the needs of rural communities. Essentially, this section would allow anyone who wants to have a permit to instead apply to the department and state instead of their local jurisdiction. This preempts the municipality's local authority and local control over their program, introduces uncertainty within that program, and allows them to bypass local programs with no cost for doing so. This would have substantial financial we have substantial financial concerns with this, as well as just the general local preemption issues that we have. In terms of Section 5, I understand we've spoke with the department about the relief valve. We don't see that there's a trigger in this. We don't see that there's any cause. There are currently appeals processes that exist within statute that we feel are adequate if there are concerns that a local government is not using the tools and resources that are provided to them. We would welcome having additional conversations with the department on this, but we feel like there are some provisions in statute which would give them the authority they're looking forward to encourage local governments to use tools.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, Daniel Eisenbeiss with the City of Portland. We'd like to also register our opposition to House Bill 3326, at least as it's currently crafted and echo some of the concerns that you've already heard. Though Section 2 of the bill speaks to rural and remote areas of the state, we do not read Sections 3 through 5 as being restricted to those areas of the state. So it raises a number of questions about the applicability of building code provisions and the ability of local municipalities to carry out building inspection programs in a uniform manner in municipalities such as the City of Portland. We have concern about some of the provisions, such as Section 3 sub 4 that would override state fire marshal rules, but also Section 5 in particular, as we read the language, appears to allow an applicant to bypass the local building inspection program for any reason they choose and have the state take over review of that application. We believe that that undermines the ability to provide uniform building inspection services in a municipality. We also believe that there are current provisions in state statute that do allow the state to step in if a local municipality does not provide a building inspection program or does not do so according to the standards that are set forth in statute. So thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Melanie Adams. I'm the president of the Oregon Building Officials Association. I'm also the assistant director of the building department for the city of Hillsboro. And our members of the Oregon Building Officials Association include code officials throughout the state, both urban and rural. They include architects, engineers, and members of the fire service. So all the people that you've heard from today are included as some of our members. Supporting our rural communities is important, and so is encouraging innovation and efficiency and regulating the built environment, but that's not what this bill is about as it's currently written. The premise of this bill is that effective, efficient, and timely administration of the state building code is best accomplished by the state rather than local municipalities. We disagree. I had comments prepared that are very similar to everything you've already heard. I will not repeat those for you, but we wish to go on record as Oregon building officials in opposition of this bill and hope very much that we see some amendments and welcome further conversations with the Building Codes Division on this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Really appreciate your testimony. Up next, I have John Noor.
I only speak for one of them today. And I shall be very brief. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is John Norm, the president of the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association. As you've heard several times today, our concern for the Fire Chiefs Association, and I can also speak with confidence for the fire marshals across the state, is the subsection that allows for the change of fire apparatus approach and adequate water supplies. Regardless of who ends up approving the plans, the responders to the emergencies that will inevitably occur at these locations are going to be local folks, and they need to be able to get to the scene to help provide the assistance to suppress the fire. Or in the case of Oregon's fire service, many fire departments provide EMS, and the access rules that get our fire engines and also get our ambulances into the scene to help provide that also. So it is a little more broad. We're concerned. We're open to work with the drafters of this bill so that Oregon's Fire Service has the ability to weigh in on this also. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. It looks like there's a bit of work and some conversations go on, and I'm sure the Building Codes Division is anxious to have that conversation. Thank you very much. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3326. And we're going to open a work session on House Bill, we're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3174. Bob, give us some information on House Bill 3174, please.
Maybe we need to give up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3174 allows a resident to claim bankruptcy exemption specified in the Federal Bankruptcy Code.
Thank you.
Walter, attention. I couldn't even get my mom to sit there.
And I have Kent Anderson and Kevin Swartz, please. Good afternoon, gentlemen. If you'd introduce yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman Holvey and
members of the committee. I'm Kent Anderson. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Oregon, a lifelong resident of Oregon. I'm also a consumer bankruptcy specialist certified by the American Board of Certification, and I'm the state chair for the National Association of Consumer Bankruptcy Attorneys. That's a group of approximately 5,000 bankruptcy attorneys around the country, many members in this state as well. I'm here to testify in support of a very short bill, and so I'll make my comments very short. We'd like to repeal 18-300, which is the prohibition against using federal exemptions in bankruptcy cases. Oregon has a system of exemptions that list certain property that's exempt from execution by courts and by bankruptcy trustees in collection of a judgment debt. In bankruptcy settings, Congress has approved an additional set of exemptions that can be chosen as an alternative to state exemptions. States were allowed the opportunity to opt out of the federal exemption scheme. Oregon is one of the opt-out states. We like it to opt back in. I've attached to my written testimony a chart that shows a comparison of the federal and state exemptions. You'll see that in many cases they're very similar. The main factor and the thing that's important here is that under the federal set of exemptions, it is possible to use a portion of the unused homestead exemption to augment another exemption or to exempt an asset that would otherwise be unexempt. Now, this is only in a bankruptcy case. It has nothing to do with collection of an Oregon judgment in court. It has only protects property in a bankruptcy proceeding from being taken by a trustee in bankruptcy. So what I'm asking is that the legislature will repeal 18-300, allow the use of federal exemptions as an option in bankruptcy cases. What this does is it protects poor people. Poor people are the ones that file bankruptcy. More than 60% of the national average of the people who file bankruptcy have less than $30,000 a year in income. They're poor. They need some help. Many of them don't own a homestead to be protected. And what this does is it allows them to take a portion of them of the exemption that we used for a homestead and apply it to something like an automobile. Maybe they have an automobile with excess equity. They can keep that automobile. It allows them to apply it to a tax refund. I've had a client that had to wait to file bankruptcy until after they filed their tax return so they could collect their tax refund, use the money to pay for important family obligations before they could file bankruptcy so they wouldn't lose the opportunity to have those funds in their family. I could go through lots of different case studies and histories, but let me just tell you that many of my clients, particularly the more economically disadvantaged, do not have homesteads to protect, and they're left with fairly small exemptions, only $3,000 for an automobile, $400 that's a pour-over that could be applied to a bank account or a tax refund under Oregon exemptions. The federal exemptions would increase that and improve their and sort of level the playing field for those people who don't have homesteads. I'm going to stop here, and I'll be glad to answer any questions that you might have.
I think we'll go ahead and listen to the next testifier first. Introduce yourself for the record, then.
Representatives, I'm Kevin Swartz. I am also a bankruptcy attorney. I practice out of state, so I practice in Washington. The firm that I'm with, Olson Daines, has offices in four states in the Northwest. We're kind of in a unique position in that way. Over the last 16 years, I've probably had my name on somewhere between 6,000 to 8,000 cases over the course of time. Being in Washington, and Washington is an opt-in state, we get to choose which set of exemptions we would like to use. California is a similar state in that they have set up their own set of exemptions that looks just like the federal ones for their residents to use. The Oregon exemptions being an opt-out is the only choice. What Mr. Anderson is trying to do is trying to get Oregonians on a level playing field with the states, our neighbors on either side. It's a very real problem. I've got many clients who will need to file a bankruptcy. They don't have a home, but they have a car, and it might be the 07 Honda that's maybe worth $6,000 or $7,000. And if they file in Oregon, they're going to lose the only car that's reliable that gets them to and from work or doctor visits or grocery shopping, whatever they need. And they're going to be given $3,000 to go find another car. And at that point, finding another car means financing something. And when you're coming out of a bankruptcy, your interest rate's going to be anywhere from 29%, I've seen as high as 36% on a motor vehicle. You're not starting at the same place, filing here in Oregon, as someone in Washington who has the ability to use that homestead, take a little bit off, apply it to the car, and when they start over, they have reliable transportation to get them to and from work, grocery shopping, all the things that everyone needs to do in their daily life. All we're asking is that Oregonians be put in the same place, which in effect is going to let them rebound faster. It's going to get them back on their feet. It's going to get them back economically, rather than having to go out and find other means, other cars, and pay through the nose and interest and whatnot. It just puts us on parity with everyone around us. I'll keep my comments short if anybody has any questions.
Questions from the committee? Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I have a couple questions. Obviously, I'm not a bankruptcy attorney. Can you help me understand, what's the definition of a homestead?
Homestead is a legal definition in the terms that we use it. It's the amount of equity in a home that you get to protect from the rest of the world, is what I would tell a client. It's if a judgment creditor gets a lien on a home, a homestead is what comes before it. So you have your mortgage, you have a homestead if there's equity, and then the judgment lien comes under. It ensures the homeowner a little bit of equity to start over with in case the home were taken.
And just following up, and so the home under current law is protected. That cannot be taken.
Up to $40,000 for an individual or $50,000 for a joint couple in under current Oregon law.
Okay.
So it's not a home. It's a dollar amount equity in a home.
Okay. And so explain to me, you've used the phrase allowing a small piece to be used, in this case as an automobile. Walk me through it at an eighth grade level.
Got it.
How that occurs.
I'll talk to you as I would my client.
Okay,
so,
thank you.
In Washington, if I had someone come in, I'd say, you don't have a home. Or more likely, if they do have a home, there's no equity these days. The values are low. If they have the 07 Honda, I would say, we get in Washington a $3,500 exemption in a motor vehicle. Well, the Honda's worth $8,000. So,
in your assumption, Mr. Chair, that Honda's paid for free and clear.
Free and clear.
Okay.
Yep. That's the single biggest asset for most of my clients is that old Honda. In Oregon, they would lose it. In Washington, I'd say, you know what? We're going to choose the federal exemptions because you don't have a home to protect or you don't have equity in the home to protect. We're going to peel off. We get to use $11,000 out of that homestead as a wild card if we don't need it to protect the home. So I can take $3,500 for the motor vehicle, that's the motor vehicle exemption. I can grab another $3,500 off the home, the wild card, and add it to it, and the car is protected.
Okay, just a follow-up question.
Sure.
Okay, and I hear you now, and I understand. But that also means then a creditor who's owed is now not going to have access to whatever the asset value is of that vehicle to liquidate that to pay the bill that's owed to them.
Let me speak to that briefly.
Is that accurate?
We're talking in a bankruptcy context, so when you say creditor, I would say probably the bankruptcy trustee representing the creditor.
But I was going to sell the car to pay off a debt. Under this bill, I would be, if using me as the person, I would now be able to say, no, you're not going to sell my car. And those dollars that would have been used from that sale to pay off a creditor now would not be available.
Well, actually, that's not necessarily the case. One, you'd have to be in bankruptcy in the first place. If you're in bankruptcy, then the bankruptcy trustee represents all the creditors and would not just represent one creditor or another creditor. In a bankruptcy setting, here in Oregon, for example, we did a study of the last 2 years' worth of bankruptcy cases that had assets that were distributed. Only 22% of that money is distributed to creditors in the state of Oregon.
Mr. Chair, I get all that. What I'm trying to get at is I have a vehicle. It's worth $7,000. I'm now going to be, if we pass this, I'm going to be able to protect that vehicle from sale, which means those proceeds that I would have been able to generate from a forced sale to pay off a creditor now are not going to be available to pay off that creditor.
Only if you file bankruptcy.
Okay. And I won't keep going on this, but I assume that's what we're talking about here. This is under a bankruptcy proceeding.
Correct. We're raising the bar to give people more to start over with, like they have in Washington and California.
Okay. Last comment, then I'll let it come, Mr. Chair. Very sympathetic, but I just want to remind everyone that there's two parties in a bankruptcy. Those that owe and those that are owed. And those that are owed exercised good faith. They might have exercised risk. They might have exercised their own assets to lend cash out. And now those folks are being asked to take a back seat. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Vega Peterson.
Thank you, Chair. I think my question is kind of a little bit of a follow-up to that. Because of what's happened recently, I think because of foreclosures or the downturn in the economy, can you speak to a little bit about, has this changed in the recent, because of the recession? I mean, is this why you're bringing this forward now? I'm just curious a little bit about the history of this.
Well, more people are being forced into bankruptcy because of the economic conditions, and I'm finding fewer and fewer people have any equity in their homes. So that's true. In most cases, people who have equity in their home borrow it to pay their creditors or sell a home and pay their creditors before they come to me to file bankruptcy. So I'm finding that a high proportion of my clients have no homestead equity and are left with very small exemptions and do fare poorly in many cases in bankruptcies because they have few assets to qualify for exemption.
So I guess a question from this. So in Oregon right now, a person that doesn't have a home, essentially, if they have household goods worth $3,000, they can, it looks like to me, unless there's some sort of, I'm not sure what bodily injury claims are for, but it looks like to me after bankruptcy, they're left with $3,400, and that's it. And
that's, to some extent, if they have other, there are other exemptions, and there are other items that are exempt. This is not a complete exhaustive list of Oregon exemptions. It's only the most common and ones that match up with the federal exemptions that would be a choice between the two. But the most common assets that people have are their household goods. They have automobiles. They have tools of the trade, and Oregon has a reasonably generous tools of the trade exemption. This would allow the bankruptcy debtor to do is to protect things that don't that aren't listed as exempt assets. For example, a car that is worth more than $3,000, and that's pretty common nowadays. It's pretty hard to find a car that's reliable that you can buy for $3,000, and so I am finding clients that have cars with $7,000 or $8,000 equity, and we have to either try to arrange a loan to borrow against that before they file bankruptcy, or they simply can't file bankruptcy, or they have to sell their car before they file, or they'll lose that and won't have the benefit of that vehicle once they get through the bankruptcy and receive a discharge.
Thank you. And it sounds like to me, and just to be clear, so a person in bankruptcy would either have to pick the federal or the Oregon. They can't use a little bit of both.
That's correct. They have they must make a choice, and then they're stuck with that choice through the proceeding.
And one more follow-up. And so it seems to me that under this system, a federal exemption may be actually better suited to people who don't have equity in their homes to try to, I guess it would be one advantage to keeping them from basically being in poverty and potentially homeless.
Well, that's true, and perhaps relying on state aid to replace what they could have paid for themselves if they retained their own assets.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. Representative Vega Peterson.
Thank you, Chair. There was another question that I forgot to ask before. What do you say is the most common causes of bankruptcy in Oregon?
There are several causes of bankruptcy, but some of the most common are loss of a job. Divorce is one of the things that causes bankruptcy. An unexpected economic circumstance. For example, a death in the family, a sick family member that absorbs all the money in the family. Those are probably 60 to 70% of bankruptcies are filed by people who have either lost their job or had an unexpected reduction in pay or an unexpected series of expenses that drained all their resources financially.
Thank you.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was looking, but I couldn't find it. But I bet you know. How long has this been in statute where we don't allow the federal exemptions to be chosen?
Well, the bankruptcy code was passed in 1978, and it had a provision that allowed states to opt out. Oregon enacted their opt-out legislation in 1981, November 11th, 1981, I believe.
Thank you. I appreciate you bringing this bill forward. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Up next, I have Jim Marquis.
He invited me, but obviously I need your permission, Mr. Chair.
Depends on how long my list is for the next bill.
Okay. I can be very quick.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Jim Marquis, representing the Oregon Collectors Association. I'm not an attorney, but I brought one. I'm here to oppose House Bill 3174. I know the proponents of the bill said that it only applies to, I believe they said it only applies to bankruptcy and not executions. The Oregon exemptions apply to both bankruptcy and executions, that is, a legal process for someone to enforce a debt that they have a judgment on. I think that's what they said, and I just would bring your attention to line 2. The relating clause says relating to exemptions from execution. So I think, and I've read the statute that's being repealed, and I think this would apply to both bankruptcy and executions. And I think it's somewhat unclear what kind of choices the debtor would have. In other words, if the intent is to say the debtor gets to choose federal exemptions or he can choose state exemptions, that's different than saying I want this federal exemption but I want this state exemption. And I think it's just very unclear. And I think at the very least, if you're going to move forward with the bill, you would want to clarify what kind of choices the debtor would have in these cases. We've spent a lot of time in Oregon on our Oregon exemptions. And Mr. Chair, you said someone might walk away with only $3,000, but my office did a fairly complete comparison to federal and state, and I think the state is fairly generous in many areas. We do have a $50,000 homestead exemption for joint owners. We protect benefits of all kinds, retirement benefits, IRAs, etc. Motor vehicles to $3,000. Personal items, household goods, TVs, radios, etc., to another $3,000. Bank deposits of up to $7,500 that's in a bank, and cash, and additionally cash for sold exempt items, guns up to $1,000, burial plots, higher education savings accounts to $7,500, personal injury recoveries up to $10,000, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, the real question here at some point in relevant to bankruptcy is how much should someone filing bankruptcy be able to walk away with? I mean, you could raise these exemptions higher. It's a policy consideration, and I think Representative Smith raised the interesting dilemma here, because you don't want to leave someone with nothing to start out with over, but on the other hand, there are creditors out there that have legitimate debts that would like to be paid for those debts. So that's really the policy question, but we would ask that you look very carefully at clarifying the bill if you want to move forward with it. Thank you. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Paul Cosgrove representing the Oregon Financial Services Association. I just wanted to comment on the technical issue. If you look at ORS 18300, it says that in accordance with the bankruptcy code, residents of this state shall not be entitled to federal exemptions. And I think that's what the proponents are talking about, removing that. But then it goes on and says nothing in this section shall affect the exemptions given to residents of this state by ORS and the Constitution. It's repeal of that second sentence that I think causes us pause about whether this goes far beyond bankruptcy and does, in fact, affect the state exemptions. So at the very least, I think that's a technical question that needs to be resolved. I'd be happy to answer your questions as well.
Thank you. Appreciate that heads up. We'll take a look at that. And I think from at least the testimony, we heard that they can't be picking this part of federal and this part of state. That in bankruptcy, they're in most states around the country where they do allow the choice of federal or state, it's my understanding, they have to pick one or the other. They don't get to go back and forth.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that's perfectly fine, and I just don't think it's clear here in the text of the bill.
Great. All right, appreciate your testimony. Thank you. With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3174. And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2826. Bob, give us a brief description of House Bill 2826, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2826 requires a debt buyer who takes legal action to collect a debt to first provide certain notice to the debtor, requires pleading filed in action to include certain information, requires the debt buyer to file certain information with the court before a judgment can be entered against the debtor, limits the interest that a debt buyer may collect upon prevailing in an action, makes a violation of those requirements an unlawful collection practice, specifies additional unlawful collection practices, increases the minimum damage award in suit for an unlawful collection practice, specifies the attorney's fees that may be awarded in that suit, extends the statute of limitations for filing such a suit, repeals the provision that a debt collector subject to and in compliance with the Federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act is considered to be in compliance with state law.
Thanks. And I'm going to call up Aaron Knott and Lynn Clark first. And Chaz Horner, too. Get three of you up here.
All right. Should I kick it off? All right. Chair Holby, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for Attorney General Ellen Rosenblum of the Department of Justice, here in support of House Bill 2826. Debt buying is a new industry. It's been around in a limited form probably since the late 1980s, but it's really kicked up in about the last 10 years and continues to accelerate. Banks have started providing loans to debt buyers to purchase charged off debt from banks. That really started to happen most aggressively in 2004 to 2006, and this is now quite a substantial industry. But because it is a new one, we're still sort of working out the regulatory wrinkles. Now, most debt sold, ostensible debt buyer debt, is credit card debt. That debt has been transferred from the original debtor to the debt buyer, who then becomes responsible for collecting on it. The Federal Trade Commission estimates about 75% of debt that is being bought and resold is credit card consumer debt. Other types of debt and smaller percentages include medical debt, utility debt, auto debt, mortgage debt, but again, mostly credit card. These are usually bought for far less than their face value, often just cents on the dollar. And that ranges depending on the freshness of the debt, and that makes sense. If you're buying a debt and the debt is very old, that suggests that nobody's been able to collect it. If it's relatively new, it may be more collectible. And on a macro level, and this is an important point, debt buying actually really has the potential to help consumers. And I'm not up here criticizing the industry. It helps lenders manage their risk, which there's a very good argument to be made could trickle down to consumers in terms of savings and more available credit. So that's a good thing. The concerns of the Department of Justice is mostly oriented towards right now there are some real spaces in regulatory coverage. So I want to talk about how those look. So with a debt buyer, again, this isn't the person or organization to whom you originally had debt. By definition, it's been sold and repurchased. So it can be a pretty significant issue for a consumer who holds debt when they start receiving correspondence from a business that they've never heard of and have never had any sort of a business relationship with, since the business collecting on the debt or organization collecting on the debt, by definition, isn't the organization with whom they established the original debt. And this creates real problems. In an era where there are all sorts of phishing scams, spam email, junk mail, many consumers, when they receive correspondence from a company they've never heard of, assume that it was sent to them in error, that it's some sort of a scam, or that they otherwise shouldn't take it seriously. That can create a problem. And in fact, DOJ's experience has been consistent with that. We've seen an uptick in the volume of complaints about debt collection practices since 2001. It's actually appeared as an area of complaint in our top 10 consumer complaints list, which we issue annually since 2001, I think, every year. Since the Department of Justice gained the ability to enforce Oregon's Unlawful Debt Collections Practices Act in 2010, we've opened 18 investigations on collection agencies, including three on debt buyers, and our experience is that this is trending upward. So the department is particularly concerned with one method of collection, which we believe 2826 will help address. I talked a bit about the confusion that can come when you receive official-looking correspondence from someone you've never heard of, but we're also concerned about how this debt can be gathered. And there are a number of ranges, many of which are okay, and they're already somewhat regulated. There are all kinds of rules saying when a debt collector can call you, how they can call you, if they can call you at home, if they can call you at your place of employment. That all already exists in the law. But because if a filing is made against you in court and you default, that's sort of the end of the deal. That can create some real problems. And for example, a default action is filed against you. Because if somebody doesn't appear to contest a legal filing for collection, it results in a default. It doesn't matter if the facts underlying that default were legally sufficient, meaning the documents can be wrong, the names can be wrong, the amount of money to be collected can be wrong. In fact, it can even legally exceed the statute of limitations provided to a debtor to make a collection action. But because in Oregon, that is actually an affirmative defense and something that you have to show up to court to represent, A debtor or consumer who has no idea that they owe debt because the debt's been bought and repurchased and they threw the correspondence away can give up valid legal arguments that they never thought to make because they never showed up in court. So from the perspective of the Department of Justice, this is a big part of what 2826 does away with. Provide some real guarantees to consumers and to debtors that they'll have some access to real notice and some showing of documentary sufficiency so that they can have the assurance that it is them, that the dollar amount is correct, and that other attendant circumstances can be demonstrated, not just that a filing was made in court that they weren't sure had anything to do with them and that was the end of the story. So I am open for questions. Thank you.
Why don't we go ahead and hear from the rest of the panel.
I'll go ahead. My name is Chaz Horner. I'm a staff attorney at Lane County Legal Aid and Advocacy Center in Eugene. That means I help Lane County's low-income residents with civil matters that affect their basic needs. About a third of my practice involves counseling people who have consumer debt problems. I have submitted as an exhibit today an example of one of the complaints that is typically filed by a debt buyer. It has very little information on it. You will see that nowhere does it name the original creditor. It does not have a breakdown of the money amount, which I have redacted for confidentiality purposes, but the money amount was not a round number like you would use to pay for a refrigerator. It's a non-round number that has other amounts included in that. So the point here is that this is an example of what a debtor receives at the beginning of this lawsuit, and very often they do not know, they do not have the information present to tell whether it is a valid claim, a valid lawsuit against them. Now, the problem that my client population faces is that
What can they do at this point? If they contest the action, if they appear, that represents a great increased risk for them. If they appear in the action, they could be subject to additional attorney's fees, additional court fees. In many cases, those fees might exceed the amount of the original debt. And for a low-income debtor who is trying to dig out, that represents a real chilling effect on asserting their rights. Now, it is true that in some cases we're able to contact the creditor, ask for the proof that they would later submit. Sometimes they respond to that, sometimes they don't. But what you see here is an example of how a debtor is provided with inadequate information to assess whether the lawsuit is proper, and just as Mr. Knott pointed out, that leads them to very often give up claims because they cannot bear the risk of contesting this lawsuit, getting more information, and then having a much larger judgment entered against them because of the fact that they had to respond in order to find out whether it was true. So again, it's not a risk-free choice whether or not to respond to this, and this is a great example of the kinds of things that, that people often get. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you.
Chair Hovley, Vice Chairs Lively and Richardson, and committee members, my name is Lynn Clark, and I am the Assistant Director of Student Legal Services at Portland State University. We are a free legal service to Portland State University students. Undergraduates have to take 4 credits. Graduate students have to take 3 credits to be eligible for our services. And we're actually paid by student fees, so we work for the students, not the university. Because the age of the average Portland University student is a little bit older, because there is a broad range of students that come to PSU, I think the cases that we see in our office are very, very representative of the sort of cases that you see on a statewide basis. But I think the thing that seems most problematic to us in our practice is the fact that there are attorneys out there that are filing lawsuits for debt buyers based merely on the word of the debt buyer that this is a legitimate debt. And with that, and I think some of the other testimony that you may hear today is if that's a frivolous lawsuit, you might have an opportunity to get sanctions or do something else, but the bell has already been rung, the suit has already been filed, and a person is already having to deal with trying to figure out what's going on. And having to require somebody to actually file an additional suit to file for a frivolous suit means even more attorney fees, and quite frankly, unless you find somebody like Lane County or somebody like Student Legal Services, these are folks that don't have access to legal services. So let me tell you a little bit about our cases that we have at PSU. During the 2011-2012 fiscal year, 9% of our cases dealt directly with the sorts of issues that would be addressed by the Consumer Credit Fairness Act. Between 2010 and 2012, we opened 206 files related to debtor-creditor issues. And as the Department of Justice explained, we're definitely seeing an uptick in those numbers. Probably in 2010, it was just a handful. I now have 2 law clerks working for us that each have 10 to 15 open files dealing with actively filed lawsuits for which we're trying to figure out debt verification. Of those 206 files, 134 we didn't pursue or we coached the student to self-remedy, so we can't really tell you how those particular suits actually turned out, but we were able to open 72 files, and of those, in 15, the debt buyer could not establish any legitimate claim whatsoever. 25 settled before filing in court, and 23 settled after filing in court, and we were able to prevail in actually 9 cases. During this period of time, we were able to save students over $80,000 in debts that were claimed by debt buyers, probably a savings that would not have occurred but for the fact that with free legal services, we can file answers, we can make discovery, we can do things that attorneys in the private sector simply don't have the time to do, and people don't have the money to pay for. In the majority of cases, I think if you heard before, students are being sued for old debts, and they aren't even sure who it is they might owe the debt to, because the debt's been purchased by a third party. They don't not even familiar with the party who's bringing the student or bringing the suit. So what happens when a student comes to us? When they come to us and we see a complaint, one of two things happens. Either we coach them how to do a debt verification letter, or in some cases we prepare the debt verification letter ourselves. More often than not, the opposing law firm doesn't have debt verification in their possession, even though they filed suit, and so we still can't even figure out how we're going to file an answer or what we're up against. In one case where a student, and I showed it, and I've attached to my written materials a sample of this letter, we coached a student how to ask for debt verification in one of these lawsuits. They merely got a letter back from the attorney saying, we looked at your file, your debt is legitimate, now pay us. That's not legitimate debt verification, but an unsophisticated person might be afraid there's a law firm on the other side, and they might pay something they don't need to pay. In other cases where we seek formal discovery and the discovery doesn't come, we see situations where law firms are threatened with a dismissal of the lawsuit because they haven't served it, they haven't done anything with it. They actually file motions to the court saying, well, we're still waiting for debt verification from our client. And I just can't imagine a circumstance. Before I was in student legal services, I was a private attorney. I did plaintiff's work. I did auto accident cases and malpractice cases and things like that. I could not imagine filing a lawsuit where I was simply going to believe the word of my client without doing some independent investigation. And this is what's going on with debt buyers. They're the attorneys that represent them are filing lawsuits that they don't have any idea of what's going on. Now, there are debt buyers and debt buyer attorneys who file legitimate claims, and with those attorneys, they give us the debt verification right away. And if we have the verification, if we have the documentation, then we're going to work with our students. We're going to counsel them about the debt. We're going to take off our attorney hat and put on our public service hat and try to teach them how to be responsible adults. We're going to work with their budgets. We're going to try to come to a plan that they can pay that debt back. But sometimes it takes request after request after request to get to that point.
If you could try to wrap up your testimony, please.
So let me tell you then finally kind of the three ways where I think that this bill would solve all those problems. So the first part of the bill requires 30-day notice before they file suit together with debt documentation. If a student receives one of those, they come into our office, we can work with them to come up with a plan. The second part of a bill requires that with the complaint, that attached to the complaint, there be this documentation of the right to bring the suit. Again, if a student comes to see us, we have all the information that we need to help them either prepare an answer or figure out how the heck they're going to pay the debt. And finally, if a consumer for some reason fails to respond to a complaint and a default is made against them, then we're going to be able to look at the default documents and figure out, did they sue the wrong person? Did they mess up their Social Security number? What's going on here? Again, in each of those ways, we have enough information, we have enough documentation so that we can counsel the student to a just resolution and give them good advice. And like I say, I've attached some documents to our testimony to kind of show the sorts of things that we get from debt buyers and debt buyer attorneys, so you can see and look at them and see if you received one of these in the mail, if even you would know what was going on.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. Up next, we have Angela Martin and
yes,
Jesse.
Miss, question before this panel.
Oh, sure. Go ahead. I didn't see a question.
Thank you. I'm reading the bill. And one thing that it says is that you must establish at the time of the filing of the complaint, I assume, business records authenticated in accordance with ORS 40.460, which I looked up, and that's the hearsay exceptions. And so essentially what you're saying is that normally a complaint is to put parties on notice as to what the nature of the claim is, but you actually want them to be putting forth evidence in the, attached to the complaint to establish their case as if they were moving for summary judgment. I mean, that's a pretty burdensome thing to put on a law firm who is filing a complaint. do you not think?
Well, except for I think that at the time, I mean, you know, at the time that they purchase all of this information, you know, purchase everything from the original creditor, this is all the sort of information that they should be purchasing. And so, I mean, I guess what's problematic to me is, I guess if I knew those folks had these things in their possession and then they give them up once you did a discovery request, you know, that would be okay. But the history is that these complaints are so bare bones. I mean, then we'd be doing Rule 21 motion pleadings and things like that. I mean, in any of these claims, maybe they're good enough for federal court and for notice pleading, but if I were working up this case like a personal injury attorney or like personal injury attorneys who defend my cases, I'd be doing Rule 21 motions on all of these first complaints that come in the door, and litigants just simply don't have the money to do that. And for those of you who aren't attorneys, a Rule 21 motion is a motion to make more definite and certain. And in Oregon, we are a state that requires at least enough pleading with specificity so you have notice of the claim against you.
Got it. Thank you. We'll be hearing about this again. I would just suggest that as we look at this, that we need to make sure that this is balanced, because attorneys that take these cases get a list of documents. They may have hundreds of cases, and some of them for $50 or $200 or $500, then they're very stale. And to require the level of evidence to even file the complaint is to essentially stop any movement in doing it, because it would be too burdensome to do it. And so I can understand the need, but I understand that maybe this has gone a little too far and that there could be something not quite so egregious or as burdensome as having to essentially prove your case before you, or when you file your documents. That's my
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate your testimony today. Up next, I have Angela Martin and Jesse Brooke. Good afternoon. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please.
For the record, my name is Jesse Brooke. Chair Holby, thank you for being here, members of the committee. So to start off, my wife and I were flooded out of our apartment back in January 2012. We moved in with a friend as a result of that, and we looked at buying a house. While getting a VA loan, attempting to get one, I found a credit agency report on my credit report. Well, I thought that was odd because I didn't owe anything because I'd already paid them. I did my research on my own and found that, in fact, it was a debt I had already paid 4 years ago. So I disputed that on my credit report, waited the 30 days for it to process like you're supposed to. After that, nothing happened. I thought that would make the debt buyer verify that I actually owe the debt, but it stayed on there. So I contacted the debt buyer directly, the collection agency, and through a month and a half long process after this, they made me prove that it wasn't my debt, which I thought they would need to have proof that it was my debt in the first place. Luckily, I had a settlement letter from 4 years ago from the original debt collector, because my father told me to keep it, and it had survived 6 moves, so I'm very lucky I still had it. So I faxed it to them probably a dozen times. Every time I called to confirm that it was received, I got answers of, no, it's not on your record, or it's on somebody's desk, but they're not here back till Monday, or it's in our system, but it's not being processed. And then back to, no, we don't see anything on your record. So finally, I made 10 copies of that letter and faxed it to them, 2 different fax numbers, every hour on the hour for 4 hours, and called them the next day. And luckily, one of those actually got to somebody, and they took care of it. It took about a week after that to get it off my record. Well, for my VA home loan application, the bank actually also needed a hard copy letter stating that it wasn't valid. So I called them and told them I needed that because I wanted a home loan, and they never sent it to me. So at that point, I decided I had enough of this and filed complaints with the Better Business Bureau and the Oregon Attorney General's office. And through mediation with the Better Business Bureau, they finally managed to fax me the letter. It was a very painful process, and for somebody who might not have the determination that I do, they might have given up. I spent 2.5 months to 3 months dealing with this, which is a little ridiculous for something that shouldn't have not been on there, because I'd already paid my debt. Mm-hmm. I will answer any questions you have.
Thank you.
Chair Holmey, members of the committee, Angela Martin with Economic Fairness Oregon. I will be brief. My testimony that I submitted to you is not brief. I think it's very long and lots of footnotes. I want to draw your attention to a couple of the items included in my written testimony. First, the scale of the problem. I think we've heard much about it. Last year in Oregon, more than 7,000 lawsuits were filed by debt buyers against Oregon consumers. So this is certainly not an insubstantial problem. Probably the best evidence regarding the lack of documentation is contained in the two most recent FTC reports, also footnoted in my testimony. The item I'd call your attention to in those is their commentary both on the documentation needs, the recommendations that we include in the documentation requests we included in House Bill 2826 come directly from those recommendations, as well as laws that are existing in other states. Also in that report, call your attention to the fact that as they were drafting it, they got a lot of pushback from the industry regarding how impossible it was to provide some of this information, including information regarding the statute of limitations. And the response that the FTC gave was, we don't buy that. If it's impossible, it is incumbent upon you to call the original creditor and figure out what the statute of limitations is, what choice of law the creditor made the contract under. The burden is actually on the one bringing the suit to ensure that the debt is not time-barred. So something to call your attention to there. Last thing I'll mention. The exhibit that Mr. Horner provided you was about Cash LLC. In the testimony, I include an article by the American Banker that references Cash LLC, talking about the contract they had between Bank of America and Cash between 2009-2010. The terms of this very contract said that the bank could not vouch for the accuracy of its own records. The contract cautioned the debt buyer that the balances were approximate, might have already been paid off, or discharged in bankruptcy. Cash LLC took those as-is contracts, filed thousands of lawsuits, including 750 against Oregon consumers in 2009 to 2012. And so that's the very heart of what we're dealing with. The debt buyers recognize and are told we don't have documentation and take those accounts to our courts and file lawsuits that become nearly impossible for consumers to fight against. With that, I close my testimony. Thank you for the time.
Thank you very much for your testimony, and I appreciate your testimony, and a good thing you had the determination you learned in the military, probably. Yes. Thank you for your testimony today. Up next, I have Jim Marquis and John Gear.
Who's up first?
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Gear. I'm a consumer attorney in private practice here in Salem, and I'm just here to talk about how this really works. And I finally decided that for a legislative committee, the best way to understand where the consumer sits in these lawsuits is if you were permanently locked into the majority in the Oregon legislature. If you personally were permanently in the minority, and you were told, well, if you want to oppose this bill that the majority supports, you have to risk some minority seats. And if you can challenge this bill that the majority supports, but if you lose your challenge, we're going to take some more seats away from you. Because that's what consumers face when they get these drive-by lawsuits. They get served by a company they've never heard of, that they've never dealt with, that provides no paperwork, nothing to document the existence of the debt. They get the stonewall treatment from the robo-dialing center in wherever Georgia. They get no response. They say, I want to pay my debt if I owe this debt, but I've never heard of you. I don't recognize this card. I don't recognize this number, what you've given me as a row of X's and four little digits. And I'm constantly being told by the Attorney General to beware of scams. well, this looks like a scam. Now, I don't have any money, and I've found this lawyer who's willing to talk to me, who says, well, if you don't owe the debt, verify the debt. And if it's wrongful, we can go after them. But if you lose, you'll have to pay their fees, and they're out. That's where it is right now. And this bill puts consumers on a level playing field by providing that a prevailing plaintiff bringing an action under this act will be able to get attorney's fees. If you provide consumers with an attorney's fees provision, they will have access to justice the same as the debt buyers. And that's essential. Thank you.
Thank you. Can you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Markey again, representing the Oregon Collectors Association, which is an association of Oregon domiciled collection agencies. We have about 60 members. I don't represent debt buyers per se. We have a lot of debt buyers from out of state that come here to collect debt. Occasionally, one of my collection agencies might purchase some debt from a client that they have, but generally speaking, the debts they're collecting are assigned to them by a creditor, usually an Oregon creditor, but sometimes an out-of-state creditor, and they're collecting on an assigned account on a contingency basis, so for some percentage of what they collect. I believe that my members try to follow the rules, and you heard the Attorney General talk about a large number of complaints from consumers relative to collection agencies and debt buyers and other debt collection activities. I would just say that last time we reviewed that for 2006-2007 complaints, which were close to 1,000 complaints, only about 10% of the complaints filed with the Attorney General's office were on our members. And in a year where we had about 70 complaints on Oregon collection agencies, my collection agencies had over 2.5 million debtor contacts. So it's a pretty good, clean record for Oregon collection agencies. I've provided you some written testimony, and I just give you a regulatory background a little bit, that this bill attempts to amend the Oregon Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act, and all collection agencies and everyone else collecting a debt in Oregon is covered by that act. And so some of the provisions of this bill will affect people other than debt buyers, people like Les Schwab or JCPenney's or whoever it is that's out there collecting a debt. So you want to make sure, and I believe that, you know, we support solutions to problems that can be exhibited, but I think we would like to see solutions that don't have a major impact on people that are trying to follow the rules. And I think this bill misses that mark. In addition to the Oregon Act, there is a federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act that was enacted by Congress back in 1979, and collection agencies, debt buyers, and attorneys are all regulated by that act. And I want to point out that that act requires those three kinds of debt collectors, collection agencies, debt buyers, and attorneys collecting debts, to send a validation notice within 10 days of beginning collection activity on a debt. And that validation notice has to state who the original creditor was, how much is owed, et cetera, et cetera. It also gives the debtor 30 days with which to say the debt isn't theirs or otherwise dispute the debt, and it contains instructions on how to do so. Now, those disputes usually are required to be in writing, but everybody that these folks are talking about should have gotten one of those validation notices when collection activity started. So, and the Attorney General talks about 18 investigations on collection agencies and others, but he didn't say how many of those were closed without action because there was no violation, and certainly some of them were. So I want to talk just a little bit about some of the things in the bill that create problems for debt collectors trying to play by the rules.
Mr. Markey,
yes.
And maybe you could provide us with or provide me with some issues specific on the issue, if I could get you to do closing instead of going line by line.
I'm not going to go line by line, Mr. Chair, but you have at the back of my testimony is 2826, and I've delineated many of those things, and I just want to say that several of the items in this bill are in direct conflict with other statutes in the revised statutes, and some of them may be unconstitutional. You have conflicts with how much interest can be charged on a purchased account. The interest rate provided for on page 3 of this bill would be 0.15% today on these debts if you got a judgment. Well, that's in conflict with the legal rate of interest. And it's also in conflict with if I have a contract that calls for 6% interest and I get a judgment on that contract, generally I get 6% interest. This is in direct conflict with that statute. The notice required to be given 30 days prior to lawsuit that spells out the statute of limitations law in Oregon is incorrect. It misstates Oregon law relative to statute of limitations and the effect that making a payment has on an account. So you'd be asking a debt collector to send something out to a debtor that was inaccurate relative to the thing. On page 5, it's required that the debt collector give the debtor a statement showing that he owns the specific debt instrument that he's filing on, and in many cases they wouldn't own it because it was assigned to them, not sold to them, and it applies to all debt collectors. So it changes the statute of limitations. The Unlawful Trade Practices Act and the Unlawful Debt Collection Practices Act are generally there to prevent people from abusing folks from fraudulent actions and such things. The provisions in this bill require very, very technical things to be included in notices. And if you miss one thing or one thing is inaccurate, the standard of conduct for these is willful, but the courts have said in Discount Fabrics, Redden versus Discount Fabrics, and I gave you the cite for that case, that willful in these cases means nothing more than ordinary negligence in not knowing something you should have known. So the ordinary negligence standard is applied in these cases. And so that means if you make a mistake and miss something, bam, you'll get sued over it.
Thank you, Mr. Markey. We'll take a look. I appreciate your thorough written testimony that points out some of these issues. So we'll take a look at these, and looks like we've got a little bit of reading to do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Are you trying to move on?
Yes. With that, I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 2826. And committee, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3144. Mark Long, can you come up briefly? committee, Bob, I think we'll go ahead and give us a real quick 30-second review of the bill.
Mr. Chair and committee members, the very brief version of the summary, House Bill 3144 allows the Department of Consumer and Business Services to administer and enforce all or part of a municipal building inspection program. The committee has in OLIS a proposed -1 amendment, which replaces the measure but clarifies the same general concept about the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services entering into agreements with one or more municipalities to administer and enforce all or a portion of the building inspection programs in a geographic area.
Thank you. Mr. Long.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mark Long, Administrator of Building Codes.
If you could just describe in about 1 minute what the -1 bill is and let us know if there's any, opposition to this -1 that you know of.
The Dash One bill, that's different from the bill as drafted, clarifies and takes more of a partnering agreement approach with local governments that are struggling. I've showed up the map many times, and this allows us to have new partnering agreements with counties. I want to be very clear that those partnering agreements are based on mutual agreement. It's not a one-sided agreement. It is when all the parties can get together and agree, then it'll allow us to combine resources, work together collaboratively, and be able to carry out those building inspection programs. It does not impact those who want to continue to run independent programs. That statute still exists. That doesn't impact them. The other thing that this does is it clarifies that we can use the local staff if there are local staff that's part of the partnering agreement under the relationship, and it adds a reporting mechanism to the legislature and to the boards that they work with, and an emergency clause because we do have some counties that are struggling. Did I do it?
And so have you had conversations with the cities? And
I've had this conversation with the cities and the counties, and on the record I want to clarify that if you look at Section 1, it talks about the may enter into agreements. Folks wanted to make sure that that is a partnership and based on mutual agreement to the parties, which is the genesis of the language. So we just wanted that on the record.
Okay. Well, we don't have the paperwork on this.
The fiscal paperwork.
Do we have the fiscal on the Dash 1?
Mr. Chair, we do not have the fiscal and revenue statements on the Dash 1 amendment.
Yeah, so we're going to hold off on that. I just wanted a chance for you to tell us about the Dash 1 and get that on the record so people know that we're considering the Dash 1 amendment. And
appreciate that, Mr. Chair.
With that, committee, Representative Smith.
Very, very quickly. Very quickly. Can you remind me, Mr. Director, was this the bill that Commissioner Grassley spoke in favor of?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
If you remember that hearing. that was a very interesting hearing.
It was a very interesting hearing. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Good memory.
Yeah, thank you.
Still loud and hearty count.
With that, I will close the work session on House Bill 3144. And committee, we're going to carry over House Bill 3070. 2662. And with that, I'll adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency.